With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Oh, lordy, lordy, lord, have I got a cracker for you today. Actor Mark Bonner and me go in on tunes. Oh, it was lovely. We spoke for just as long after the interview as well. That's a good sign. Just a wonderful, warm, engaging, lovely gent, as you're about to find out. Before we get on with that chat, just a few thank yous. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and everyone at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. Thank you to you lovely lot for supporting and getting behind it and sending nice messages. And, you know, I see you kind of doing the likes, loves and the retweets and, you know, all of that stuff. So thank you. Thank you very much. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, then when do you get to the end of my chat with Mark? Go and explore the back catalogue. If you like my conversations with wonderful actors, then go hear me talk to Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Michael Smiley, Thomas Turgoose. Oh, gosh, the list goes on. Amanda Abington. There's loads. So go and explore that. And we talk about lots of kind of great rock music from the early 90s, a lot of which was produced by a former guest as well, Butch Vig. That's a lovely chat. And then, you know, there's you know, other rock and roll legends in the back catalogue that I've been lucky enough to get some time with over Zoom during lockdown. And those include the Foo Fighters, Tommy Lee of Motley Crue. There's bloody stack. So go and have a good rummage around, because there's 300 and about 350 episodes now that you can go and listen to all for free. So all I ask in return, if you've got a split second, is give us a subscribe or drop us a comment or give us a like, love or a share or a retweet on the socials or just tell your mate. Go old school. Just give him a nudge and go, there's this podcast called Off the Beaten Track. It's this bloke from Essex that's got a lisp and he just kind of natters away about records with some lovely people. So, do that. And if you want to do the Patreon thing, then there's radio shows and video episodes and loads of bespoke episodes over there. And that's about 79p a month. And you can find out about all of this stuff at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Right, there we go. Let's get on with today's episode. Please enjoy this absolute lush conversation with the gentleman that is Mark Bonner. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now. And you may have heard me talking about the products from the Cacao Bar, and there's gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to. And all you've got to do is, just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast. this Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stew Whipping. Okay, recording. Mark, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm all right. I stopped you from chatting a moment ago because you was kind of documenting your meltdown over choosing these records. So before we even get on with any of this, just tell me about that process and did it really fry your brain?
Oh, fucking hell. So you got in touch, I don't know, when, June or something, was it maybe?
A couple of months ago, yeah.
Oh, yeah, a couple of months ago. And, so ever since then, because it's your questions, I mean, and I hadn't heard of your podcast until you got in touch. And as soon as you got in touch, I went away and listened to Chuck D straight off because I'm a massive Public Enemy fan. And that was me. So I've listened to about, I don't know, maybe 30-ish of them so far.
Oh, okay.
People I know, mostly. So, you know, Tony Pitts, I texted you after listening to Tony. And I love hearing other people's choices. And I've got so much out of it as well. You know, I've found new bands. I've found new songs from that I'd never heard from bands that I know. So it's been great. It's like a desert island discs, but a bit better, you know.
Oh, I'll take that, mate.
So I mean, it was horrendous trying to juggle or because it changes on a daily basis what you kind of, especially the intro one, also the sort of, you know, your school years one, and also your clubbing one. I mean, not that I was ever a clubber, but. I certainly, there was a club we went out to regularly, songs kept coming back to me about that, you know. But I just thought, well, I'll choose the ones that are the ones that I remember, you know, the most, or that sort of stand out the most from any particular given moment, rather than trying to condense it, you know. So I chose secondary school rather than primary school, because there was a few songs at primary school, you know, that I could have chosen, but no, it was hugely enjoyable, albeit intensely frustrating.
Good. That's what I want. Well, let's get the ball rolling, because there's quite a few honourable mentions for this one, and this is generally always the one that people struggle the most with. And so, Mark, with the greatest ever intro, please.
This is the one that changed the most up and changed again last night and then changed back. But since the very beginning, this is one of the first ones I thought of. And it's a song called West End Blues by Louis Armstrong, which has only been sort of in my field of musical vision for about 12 years, I think. I did a one-man show in the West End in 2008 called Novecento, and it was about a jazz trumpeter who was telling the story of his friend who was the pianist in the band that they played on in this ocean liner. They were on an ocean liner that went back and forth to Europe, between Europe and New York. And his friend had been born on the ship and left on the ship, and he'd been sort of adopted by the crew, and he grew up and they named him Danny Boodman T.D. Lemon Novecento. That was his name, hence the title of the play. But in preparation for watching, for playing that part, I watched this brilliant series called Jazz by Ken Burns, made by Ken Burns, which was on PBS. It was made in about 2001. And it just took you through the whole history. And I was totally ignorant of jazz, really. But it took you from 1917 right up until present day. And about the evolution, about how it started, and about who were the sort of, you know, who were the sort of forerunners of the sound, that particular sound, and how it all came together, you know, from different musical influences. And this song, West End Blues, was often songs where they played snippets of songs in the documentary, but this one they played in its entirety. It's only like 3 minutes 18 or something, because the... what's his name? Wynton Marsalis, who's a jazz trumpeter, he talked about this song in such a beautiful way. He said that he played it to his tutor one day. He'd found it somewhere, I don't know, an old pressing of it or something, and he played it to his trumpet tutor. And he said he sat there in silence. And as soon as it finished, he kind of looked up at him with tears in his eyes and said, "Put it on again." And I just thought that was such a kind of wonderful way of describing what it did to that guy, you know, yeah. who had been a jazz tutor all his life. And the intro itself has about five different time signatures in it, you know, because Louis Armstrong was an absolute fucking genius, you know. What he did with that instrument and with his vocal instrument as well, and both sometimes at the same time. And I think what's wonderful about the whole song is that it kind of encompasses almost every human experience, I feel, when I listen to it. And I listen to it on a regular basis, that song. It just encompasses everything that is about being a human being. You know, it's wonderful.
And so did that kind of open the doors, you know, that gig as well as that track to jazz? Because I don't know about you, but jazz is something that I've kind of started to explore as I've got older. It wasn't it wasn't on my radar when I was 21. Felt like something that I just kind of, I don't know if you have to be of a certain age to start to kind of appreciate jazz. I don't know.
I think it's jazz and country are the two things that approach 100%. You. As you get into your later years, you suddenly start listening to Emmylou Harris and going, "Do you know what?"
Well, look, with that in mind, let's talk about the honourable mentions, because to go from something that kind of, you know, starts to chime into your life in, you know, as you start to hit your 40s, etc. I mean, Faith No More's From Out of Nowhere. I mean, that's taking the roof off when you're 18, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I went to see them in, 92 maybe, or 91, at the Battlelands in Glasgow. They've been one of my favourite bands since time immemorial, I think. I can't remember when I got into them. Heavy metal was my first love. AC/DC was my first gig, right? But Faith No More came along probably around about the time The Real Thing was released, which was, I think, 89.
It was.
89? I mean, when you still listen to that album now and you go, "What? There's not a song on it that sounds okay," you know? It's an incredible piece of work.
I mean,
and he's an incredible artist, Mike Patton, I think.
Man, like, let's not overlook his vocals. They're incredible, mate.
Yeah.
Like, and the band, I mean, I've forged a good friendship with a guy called Jason Perry, who was a singer in a band called A, who come on this podcast. And afterwards, we were sitting here, this was pre-pandemic, this is my little kind of garden bar like type studio. So we're sitting having a little beer, and we started talking about From Out of Nowhere. And he went, "Oh, do you like Faith No More?" I went, "I think there's a double snare in that intro where it just goes, bop, bop, da-na-na-na-na." And he went, "That's the greatest snare ever." And we literally just sat there drinking this beer, enthusing about this fucking snare drum on From Out of Nowhere. And yeah, it's incredible, that track. And the energy that record's got, like, still holds up. I still DJ in my alternative club. And you still drop that now and you get a reaction from 18-year-old kids that have probably no idea who Faith No More are. But yeah, as a band, you know, even moving forwards, like what Angel Dust done for music was just pioneering. I'd never heard anything like that before. And, you know, that paved the way for so many bands, I thought.
And again, his vocals on that, you know, the fact that, and I think that's where he, because he was very young when they did The Real Thing, wasn't he?
Mm.
And I think by the time Angel Dust came around, he'd really kind of found his... whatever it is he is, you know. But he, you know, on songs like Not Caffeine, what's the one where he goes, "Yeah, I swear a lot," what's that called again?
Kinder
when he adopts that character, you know, that so, you know, all that stuff is really fucking fascinating and brilliant and weird and quite arresting. You know, it takes you by surprise. So that I absolutely love Faith No More. And still surprising now. And all the other stuff he does. I mean, Mr. Bungle, I've never quite. I've tried.
Same here, mate.
There's something just a bit too sort of proggy. I'm not a proggy at all.
Same.
And there's something just a bit too kind of like, you know.
It's awkward, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it would take a lot more time than I've got.
It was Mr. Bungle. All of my mates were all into like all of the stuff that was going on then, Jane's Addiction, Faith No More, all of that stuff, and we loved all that scene. And then there'd be the ones that took it the extra length and was like uber nerds for it, and they were the ones that were always talking about Mr. Bungle and Primus, and they were the two bands that I couldn't get my head round.
I saw Primus support Jane's Addiction, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they again at Barrowlands, and I bought Seas of Cheese.
Yeah,
it's stupid even saying that, but they're another kind of, you know, if you venture too far down that road, you go to what's that band's name?
Fishbone.
No, I was going to say it's not House of Pain. It's not that. Oh God. Do you know that band that did the auditions for the drummer? They auditioned about five drummers. What are they? Fuck are they called? They're like proper, like heavy prog. It's weird. They're what are they called? This is what every conversation like with me like this now.
So am I, mate.
Since I was about 45.
It's what happens. It's what
the guy that plays with that thingy band. They're on that program.
Exactly. That comes hand in hand with jazz and country, that, mate.
Yeah, no. It's the repetition with jazz and country. That's what appeals to
me. What were the other honourable mentions that you had, Mark?
Bob and Earl, Harlem Shuffle, because I think that is one of the all-time great. And I knew it before it became Jump Around.
Yeah.
And it, as often happens with fantastic pieces of music that are necked for other fantastic pieces of music, it spoils the original for a long, long time, or it spoils people's kind of getting, you know, because that's the very, very top of the song. Yeah. So for years, people were like, "Jump Around." No, it's not fucking Jump Around. Listen to this, because Harlem Shuffle is the most kind of beautiful, I don't know what the best, sultry, kind of sexy, I love what it does to me when I'm listening to it.
It's got such a groove in it.
Oh, it's kind of that, it's that kind of lazy groove, kind of like, it's kind of like Superstition or something, you know, where it's just kind of like in you and you're like, oh, what's happening to me, you know? Back in the day, obviously, not now.
You know, of course.
But it kind of affects you. It affects you inside. It kind of does. It works wonders for your interior movement.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love that. Was that all the honourable mentions I had?
Was there one more? Let me just...
I can't even... Oh, hang on. I put my phone, didn't I?
I've got mine here as well. There's another one. Richard Jobson and his Merry Men.
Oh, do you know what? And they'll cut a bit, well, Stuart Adamson will come up a bit later on. But that was one of the first songs I remember on Top of the Pops, you know, when you're watching, or when you used to watch Top of the Pops, and something, that song came on that really kind of made you go, when you were wee, you know, when I would have been... Oh, I don't know. What was it? 78?
Was it Into the Valley? Maybe.
So I would have been 10. It really kind of, I think there was a Generation X, there was Mirror in the Bathroom, and Into the Valley were the three songs I remember slapping me across the face.
Yeah.
I was just too young for punk. I maybe 2 or 3 years older and I would have been like fucking at the front. But
yeah.
It just passed me by. I remember watching that or hearing that and just being kind of like, holy shit. And I think it's just got one of the best kind of like call to arms type intros, you know?
Absolutely. And Jobson's performance on Top of the Pops, I mean, I've seen that a fair few times now. He's doing that kind of weird sort of kicking dance, isn't he? And he just looks so frenzied. It's just brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. What a
and the fact, well, I just realised I said a call to arms, but I mean the subject matter for a what was he, 17 or 18 or maybe younger when he wrote that, is an incredible achievement for a really young boy, you know, to be savvy enough to. I mean, I know he was reading a lot of those kind of history books and stuff at the time. I can't remember, there was one in particular that he's mentioned in interviews that he was reading. And I can't remember what it was, but for that to come out the mouths of a young boy is incredible. That was, and also it keeps coming up bizarrely on, you know how Spotify runs, if you run over a playlist that you've got, it'll start just playing whatever is in connection. And that keeps coming up all the time just now. It's bizarre. It's like, it's kind of, I don't know what it's trying to do to me, but,
Oh, it's a belter of a tune, though, Mark.
It's a beauty, isn't it? Go on.
Let's take you back. First song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please, mate.
Okay. This was, I think, only probably a year after Jobson. Well, I'll tell you what it is first. It's Union City Blue by Blondie. And this almost was my favourite intro. This bit back and forth and back and forth, because I think it's just, I mean, apart from being an incredible song, the intro is just fucking, oh my God. And it's forever kind of linked, because I think the first time again I saw that or heard the song was on Top of the Pops.
Oh, boy.
So with the video, with that helicopter shot, from like, you know, this kind of industrial but obviously American, North American wasteland, you were sort of thinking, what the fuck? And then suddenly they're playing and it's massive dry dock and you're like, oh, you know, I was 11.
There's
Debbie Harry and Clem Burke, you know, that man.
What a
that
dude.
Man can, I just listened to it before I came on just now, really loud because I'm down the bottom of the garden. Fucking hell, he beats the crap out of those drums, he beats the crap out of them in such a, again, an arresting way. So he'll do things that you just, that surprise. He's a constant surpriser, you know, Clem Burke, as a percussionist.
But he never overpowers the song.
No.
Like, if you, again, like Dreaming, like the urgency of the drumming on Dreaming's fucking ridiculous. But... yeah. It works. It doesn't sound like some kind of prog dude having like a 5 minute wank on his drum kit. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it works perfectly. And he looks fucking cool constantly.
He always, I know, man. Those suits, that hair. I'm a lapsed drummer, but that was kind of one of the things that made me want to play the drums was watching him. Him and Roger Taylor were the two kind of like, I mean, Roger Taylor was mostly the spectacle because he had that. I had Queen Live Killers and he had that. There was a picture of this, just this fucking huge backlit drum kit, you know, and you're like, I want to hit that. But Clem Burke with that, just he had a small, you know, two toms and one floor tom, but just what he did with it was just awe-inspiring.
Absolutely.
And the very first time I got to play a drum kit was my dad's pal's brother was in a band and we went, I can't remember why, but dad took me along to their band practice one day and I'd never been in a rehearsal room. And the smell that rehearsal rooms have, that smell of Mr. Sheen mixed with sweat. And that was what hit me first. And then he had a big red premier kit, just like Clem Burke's. But not only that, there was a massive poster of Clem on the wall.
Nice.
I was just like, with the same kit, you know. And that was the first time. So that just, you know, that just made me into a drummer for a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, that song, the way she sings through, you're right about that he doesn't overpower the song, because she finds a way through the, it's the same on, it's the same, what was I listening to earlier on? I can't remember, but she has this way of finding her way through the song that kind of perfectly complements what he's doing, because he is the pretty much the next biggest thing to the vocals
100%
in each song. He's a big drummer, I think, you know. But yeah, what a band, man. What an album that album is, Eat to the Beat. That was my first Blondie album.
What a cracker that is. And you know, you can't.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Underestimate how much of an impact Debbie Harry had on young lads, on any lads.
I know.
It was like, wow. Because for me, that was the first pop star I saw that, you know, I would look at your Madonnas and things like that and think, oh, yeah, beautiful. But Debbie Harry was cool.
Yeah.
Debbie Harry was just, wouldn't take shit. She just looked like she was just everything. Like, she just had so much swagger. I don't think there was a cooler person walking the planet than at that point. Debbie Harry was bossing it.
I love that picture of her and Bowie and Iggy Pop. Have you seen that one on the sofa? And they're both kind of like that. Of course you are.
Absolutely. When you think of like the ego and testosterone and stuff that must have been floating around CBGBs, and she just glided through that place. Do you know what I mean? Like the height of punk, she was just forefront, incredible,
and unafraid to kind of unafraid to march forward as well. Because a lot of those guys at CBGBs, they kind of, you know, they were albeit fucking amazing bands. She kind of, you know, because they all took the piss when they sort of heard, they realised that she was going in not a disco direction. Atomic and, you know, all
Heart
that
of Glass, they're disco bangers.
Heart of Glass, yeah, exactly. But didn't lessen the band's impact or artistic integrity at all, I don't think, you know.
Not at all. Well, let's stay in those formative years, Mark. The song reminds you of your time at secondary school, I believe.
Secondary school. Well, if it was primary, it would have been the soundtrack of Grease. Brilliant. I'll say that now. I can remember singing, which one was it, in the playground? Oh, God, I can't remember. It must have been Sandy or, anyway. But secondary school. Well, first of all, I've given you two, haven't I? Because I just couldn't. It was unfair to choose, because there was two very. Even though heavy metal was a kind of a background, believe it or not, to all this, and has remained so. You know, I'll still put on Slayer. I'll still put on, here you go again, eh? Thingy with the thingy. The guy that's got the thing. Oh, I can't even mind his name. The live album, If You Want Blood.
Right.
It's one of the best live albums of all time. So I'll still put on ACDC, I'll still put on Slayer, and they were always a backdrop, not Slayer, but, you know, Maiden, DC, Kiss was a big one for me. Just I loved anything theatrical, basically. Yeah. So, Adam and the Ants, Ant Music, when that appeared again on Top of the Pops, and it was the video, and here was this guy, and this is probably this is probably the next best thing to punk. This got me at the right age. You know, I was maybe 12 by then. So when I saw Adam Ant with his culturally appropriated white stripe and his, you know, pirate garb and the little things in his hair and that kind of angry look in his eye, mischievous angry look in his eye, that really, you know, floated my 12-year-old boat.
Yeah.
And, yeah, really kind of, that was one of the first albums I bought, I think. Queen's Greatest Hits, I remember I had. And I think that was the one I actually kind of, I think that might have been a present, but, you know, Kings of the Wild Frontier, I actually went out and bought. But I just think that he kind of, struck there was a fine balance between, because I mean there was a lot of kids my age were into them, but looking back now, because you know I listen to this stuff, my kids are 10 and 6, so I mean a lot of the stuff they listen to now I'm sort of like, what? And I go back and I go, well, what was I listening to? I shouldn't be so judgmental. I go, no, Matt, the stuff I was into was really good, actually.
Yeah.
So, but even Adam and the Ants, although on the surface they can appear sort of poppy and stuff, he was still a brilliant lyricist and quite sort of evocative and poetic. You know, songs like Ants Invasion, you know, was a really kind of weird kind of good, you know. Peroni was a great guitarist, I think. It really helped. Yeah, and helped him, Adam find his voice as much as he did, you know. I mean, you can tell, I mean, but when they split up, he wasn't as good, you know, on his own.
Fully formed pop star then at that point, wasn't he? I think, like, that.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult, wasn't it? I think
it was really weird. I was chatting to my mate about Prince Charming last night, and you know, you instantly think of Dinah Dawes and the video and all of that, but it's no Ant Music.
It's no Ant Music. The fire's kind of gone. I think it's they very, for some reason, very quickly became a parody of themselves. And I don't, you know, who knows. I know there's a documentary, and he's written a book as well.
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to be really good. I mean, he's had a hell of a journey, hasn't he?
Yeah, he really has. But he didn't drink and he didn't smoke. He was just desperate to be a pop star. He just wanted to be a pop star. And that's the thing on that documentary that really kind of comes through, that, like, he just wanted to be famous. Like, he just wanted to be a pop star. And obviously he achieved that, you know, a really, really high level. And I think when that was taken away, I think that's when, you know, things started to get tricky for him. But as we've seen over the last 5 years, he's back looking as cool as ever now.
Selling out huge shows. Instagram. And he looks brilliant now.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. But I mean,
I would probably go and see it. I never saw them live. I was just that bit too young, or I missed them or whatever. But I'd probably go and see him. I mean, I'd be the oldest man in the room, I'm sure, but not.
I doubt that. I think, though, as you know, as a young lad, like, again, like, you know, I think we're very close in age. Like, turning on Top of the Pops and seeing, like, Adam Ant was like, wow. You know, that wasn't, you know, I can only imagine that was like seeing Bowie 10 years previously or whatever. It was like such an impactful look and sound, and, you know, the two drummers, it was like, what's going on here?
Yeah,
you know, because it sounded quite tribal, didn't it? It was like really, really strange. And he just looked...
Unplug the jukebox and do us all a favour. You know, that music's lost its taste.
Yeah.
You know, it said kind of everything to the punk would have said to the, you know, 3-4 years earlier to all those guys, you know. It said that all to us at that time. Yeah.
So you're singing the hits of Grease in the playground as a young lad. So
you know what? I got, on my 10th birthday, I got a tub of Brill Cream and a PVC jacket. I was that into it. I absolutely loved it. Brill Cream's got a lot to answer for, actually.
I used to do the same. I used to kind of, when I was in the bath, I'd always kind of like flick my hair back and try and get the little curl. Yeah. And I think it was like a hybrid of wanting to be Danny Zuko or the Fonz at that point as well. Like,
oh, Fonzie lasted the test of time as well.
Absolutely. Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor. Egg Fried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this. They have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, E-G-G-S-A-L-A-D, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Egg Fried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. So did you enjoy your time at school?
I moved around a lot when I was at primary school, so I kind of had to think of my feet a bit.
Why was that? Why did you move around a lot?
Well, my dad was an artist, and he worked for the development corporation, a couple of development corporations at the time. There was there's five new towns in Scotland, and they were sort of just being built when my dad graduated from art school, and the development corporations employed artists to work alongside planners and architects to help with the, you know, the look and the aesthetic of the new town. So it was quite a novel, interesting and sort of, in some ways, revolutionary idea, you know, and it made for art that still kind of still exists now. I've just actually just done a documentary about it with my dad a few weeks ago. We went around all the new towns in Scotland and talked to various politicians and historians and other artists about their art and about what it, and residents as well, and what it means to them, and you know, and its history and the effect it's had on art in general, sort of moving forward from those times. So that was one of the reasons that we moved around. Was dad? It was a short contract, so he would work. He worked for Glenrothes in Fife. We were there for a year. Where I started school, then we moved to East Kilbride, sort of kind of near Glasgow, and that was for about 6 months or a year. So again, I went to a different school there, and then eventually we moved to Stonehouse, which is sort of in between Edinburgh and Glasgow, and that was from ages of about 8 to 11. So I was there for the sort of, or 7 to 11 maybe, I was there for the sort of biggest chunk of time, and that was the playground where I was singing. To try and impress whatever girl it was.
So was you sort of confident in that respect? Like, because changing schools, I mean, I never had to do that, and the thought of it would have terrified me. So was you confident enough to sort of start a new school and kind of sort of throw yourself out there a little bit?
I don't remember. I mean, I think primary... I think it just kind of happened to me. I didn't know, you know, I didn't have any say or choice in the matter. I mean, the biggest wrench actually was going from Stonehouse when I was at the end of primary 7, which would be year 6 here, going to Edinburgh to go to secondary school. So that was a really big, because I had by that time I'd forged a good friendship. My best friend Stuart McLaren, and he so we, you know, that was kind of weird and kind of upsetting. You know, I remember being quite emotional about it because I hadn't, the last time I'd moved, as I say, I was 7 or 8. So you kind of like, you're not really forged, you're not really connected in that way to a place or people at that age. So yeah, but and when I went to secondary, I got the piss ripped out of me quite a lot for my accent, mostly because my accent was more West Coast. So I was a wee bit more like that. All right, I used to speak up and down like that quite a lot. But so, after about a year in Edinburgh, it kind of flattened out a little bit more, just like blending with the natives. I didn't find it hard. And I guess I was always quite adept at arsing about, you know, because if you can make people laugh, they won't swing at you, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm still doing it. And they're still not swinging as yet.
Okay, track, or where are we? Four. First record you remember buying from a record shop, please, mate.
Oh, well, that's my metal roots coming out. So it was 90, no, wait a minute. Was it 99 pence? I want to say it was 99 pence. Anyway, I think it was either 99 pence or 79 pence. But it was Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden. Again, that theatricality, I think there's a I love a band that has a sense of the theatrical. And there's arguably, well, no bigger theatrical metal band than Maiden. But I think also that it might have been the first sort of heavy rock record that I'd heard. And again, Top of the Pops responsible for all these things, you know. But that video, that wristband that he had that went all the way up there was just like, what the... And his tight trousers and his hair and just his kind of... His swagger, Dickinson's swagger, even though he's a bit of a tit now. What is it with all these fucking... What is it? Morrissey, fucking Ian Brown, you know, Bruce Dickinson, you know. Why does it have to happen?
I don't know, mate.
Is it a sheltered life? Is it kind of, you know, you suddenly find yourself up there on this pedestal? Well, Morrissey's always been a little bit fucking weird, but yeah, you've...
But we didn't see that coming, though. The stuff Morrissey. That he started to... Oh, mate, I'm smothered in Smith's tattoos. It breaks me up, mate.
Oh, are you? Oh, mate, well, listen, when we get late, I didn't... There's none of them in there.
Mm.
I just find it too hard. But they were, for about 3 or 4 years, they were, you know, I saw them in 86.
Oh, wow.
On the Queen is Dead tour. And, one of the best gigs of my life, you know. And I love them so much. I still love Mar. I think Mar's such a fucking great guy.
When I set this up, I had two guests that were like, I've got to get to speak to these people. And one was Johnny Marr. I've not got there yet.
Oh, you will. You will. Are you testing
just
his people?
He's so cool, isn't he?
Oh, he's the best, man. He's the best. And he's when you listen to what he was doing, because it used to, well, when I got in at them, it was all, not all Morrissey, but, you know, it was what he was saying. It was those fucking lyrics. And the humour, you know, that everybody always fucking misses, or, you know, people who don't fucking know or care go, oh, yeah, I'm so miserable. You go, no. Go away. Yep. But then as time goes by, and I don't listen to them a huge amount, but I have listened to them a wee bit in preparation for this, because I thought, well, I'll go back and What Difference Does It Make was on the best intro for a while as well. Because, I mean, there ain't no better guitar riff, really, than that. Right,
it's special.
And it's so short, but it just makes you go, huh!
Yeah.
but you, when you listen to what he's doing in those songs, you know, you go, wait, he's kind of ethereal. A lot of the stuff, you go, where is he? What? I can't quite work out the guitar. You know, it's not in your face. It's in and around, beautifully in and around everything, yeah. You know. Yeah. Oh, man, they were a band.
Oh, mate, really were. And like you say, it was them Morrissey lyrics that just spoke to you as a teenager, do you know what I mean? And like, and then the stuff that seems to be coming out of his mouth that the press are jumping on, it's like, I can't get my head around it. I just think, is this some elaborate Morrissey joke that we're not getting? I don't know.
No, it's like, but it's not funny.
No, it makes no fucking sense.
No, I know. It's just, and Bruce Dick, I didn't know that Bruce Dick was a Brexiteer.
No way.
Yeah, big one. And I saw an interview. There was a Sky News, I think, interviewed him, which I saw on Twitter. Somebody posted on Twitter a few weeks ago, and he was like going, he was saying, I can't remember what the interview was even about now, but it was, I think it was about the lorries or the shortage of this and the shortage of that, and he was sort of going, I don't understand, why can't we just get, you know, we got it. And I was like, you fucking, and he was arguing, saying, you know, people know I'm a proud Brexit voter. I was like, I didn't, you fucking asshole. Thanks for just scrubbing another. Because I find it really hard. I know you've talked to guests about this before, but I find it really hard. And I know Adam Buxton does it a lot when he talks about separating the art from the artist, you know, being able to kind of tease those two things apart so that you're not fucking thinking about what's going on while you're listening to the music or looking or reading or whatever it is that they're responsible for. I find it very hard. Add into the fucking mix, I was a massive Queens of the Stone Age fan. And I went to see them about 4 or 5 years ago at Wembley Arena, and they were just, it was an unbelievable, because they were so good. And the whole play, you know, when you see 10,000 people doing that, it's the most thrilling fucking thing. Then like the week later or 2 weeks later, he kicked that photographer in the face. You see that?
Yes.
And
grim,
that, man. I never put them on. I can't do it, you know? I was just like, oh, you're a prick.
He tried to make excuses for that, and he's like, mate, you can see it. He just kicked someone in the fucking face, man.
I know. Yeah. He leaves his foot out when he's turning. He knows what he's doing. You know, I'm having problems with this, with that, with drugs, whatever it is. I don't know. I can't remember what he said in his apology now. It's like, you know, I just don't get that kind of behaviour. And it soils, unfortunately for me, probably, but it soils. I can't get out the present person with what they did in the past, you know. I can't get out of my head. It's a shame.
Yeah,
it's a title for a song, can't get out of my head. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh yeah, Iron Maiden.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's
how did metal find its way into, like, what was it you liked about, you mentioned the theatrics of Dickinson, but and I guess you could say the same for Kiss, but like, did you like that kind of aggression in music?
I've always liked that kind of I think Tony said that when you spoke to Tony Pitts, he was saying about I can like anything as long as somebody means it, you know. And I guess that was the first thing that came into my sphere of listening, where somebody fucking seemed to mean it, you know?
Yeah.
Usually because they're screaming at the top of their voice, or there's some kind of amazing, like, busy lick going on. But AC/DC, I think, Let's Get It Up was the first sort of, either that or Run to the Hills, I can't remember. But it was one of those moments where you go, it was thrilling, you know, for a young boy. That theatricality and Kiss, man. I remember putting on, like, shows, miming to Kiss for my grandma. We covered the floor in newspapers, and we got the two sort of bedside tables, I think, me and my brother, and stood on them. And I'd bought blood capsules from the joke shop, and we mined to Detroit Rock City or something, I don't know what it was, for my grandma, who was looking after us, who was very posh and wore a wig and, you know, oh dear, dear, dear. And I thought she'd be the most shockable. But she just sort of, fuck knows what she did to make it that. I'm going to put on a show for you, Grandma. So yeah, I forced my wee brother. Oh, he liked it. He's a big Maiden fan. He's a bigger Maiden fan than me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that sense of the theatrical, I think, really appealed to me, and that pomp and circumstance, but also like, you know, fucking hard assed.
Yeah.
Rock and roll.
But you, I mean, I still think that finds its way through in things like Faith No More that we've just mentioned as well, and Queens of the Stone Age. It's like, it's not fucking around, is it? But there is a rock and roll theatric.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To it as well.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's almost inherent in rock and roll, isn't it, really? I mean, you when you choose what chords you're going to write a song with, you're making a statement.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those bands, I don't musically know what I'm talking about really, but you know, a lot of those bands in their, you know, it's inherent in the music, that theatricality, I think, you know.
Yes.
And I love it. I love a great frontman, you know.
Yeah,
there's nothing more thrilling than watching a really good frontman or woman.
Mm. The song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
All right, okay. And now I've put this could have gone anywhere, because clubbing and me didn't really, I mean, I was never a regular clubber for a long period of time. So it happened in sort of pockets. So at one point on this list, was, do you remember a song called Male Stripper by Man to Man?
It's a fucking great record, man.
I
love that record.
It's like a really fucking good dance record.
Yeah, man. Like,
but that almost made this list, because there was a time when my best pal in the world is called Keith Taylor, and me and him make collaborative Spotify mixes all the time. We've been doing it ever since it became a thing on Spotify. So we've got about 80, we're on 80 something, I think. We used to go out to this club called Lacuna Head, which was in the Carlton Studios in Edinburgh. But before that, which is where my song choice comes from, but before that, I used to, like a couple of years before, I had a good pal called Leslie, who I used to go out with. And I went out with her and all her sort of female pals. And at that time, I had a black Mohican. And I can't remember why, but I can't remember what possessed me to have a Mohican and dye it black. Anyway, and I used to wear eyeliner and harem pants, and I was kind of a toying with new romanticism sort of after it happened.
Yeah.
I think, or maybe not, maybe it was about the time. I think I liked a lot of, again, that theatricality, you know, so Spandau Ballet in the early days when they had their big fucking sashes on, work till you're muscle bound and all that, you know. And Adam and the Ants, of course, and but also the Smiths were vaguely on the horizon. But I just thought it would be cool to have, like, you know, a bit of a different look. So I did. So I went very different, and I used to go out with clubbing with them. But I can't remember what the club was called. But that was the song that was always on, was Male Stripper.
Yeah,
and I was always fucking up dancing to it. I loved it. But the song I've chosen isn't that. It's What Goes On by Velvet Underground, because when we went to Lacuna Head, and that was probably the most elongated and the club I visited the most. It was a great fucking club, man. You would have loved it. It was just like loads of fucking smoke everywhere, and just and lots of chemically inebriated young people. And I just, so most of the time, the musical memories from that aren't dancing. They're sitting at a table listening to fucking the Velvet Underground or Dinosaur Jr. or Butthole Surfers or fucking all manner, or Husker Du, or, you know, all these amazing fucking bands that were around. But listening to that and just blinking and going and rushing. Just fuck it off my tits, going, this song is probably the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life.
And that sentence will be repeated every 3 minutes, yeah?
Yeah. Hold on a minute! You know, it was... And what goes on was one of those that they played sort of every week, I think, you know, and whatever chemical it was, it seemed to bridge whichever. It didn't matter what chemical it was. The Velvets were always a fucking great listen, you know.
Wonderful.
So that's the Lacuna Head, man. That Carlton Studios is gone now. I saw Nirvana there in 91, about 2 weeks after Nevermind was released.
Wow.
And so it was Lacuna Head was upstairs at Carlton Studios. And the gig, the band, the venue was downstairs, and it was like the capacity, what I think was supposed to be 800 or something. There was 2,000 people. They just like fucking crammed them in, you know. So it was like that, but fuck, I was right at the front, you know. I was staring up Kurt's nose. It was just fucking incredible. It was at the peak of my love for them as well, you know. Yeah. Oh man, I love that band so much.
Have you gone back and like slung on Nevermind like recently?
Not recently. The way I listen to music is quite, because I know you asked this question, and I often think I'm like that. I don't make it down here very often. There's my turntable, you know. I don't make it down here too often to just put on an album anymore.
Yeah.
So it's usually I'm doing the dishes and I've got my headphones on before I have to go out and read a story for the kids, you know. So it's like a couple of songs at a time. So I haven't put on the album, not recently, but I've listened to various songs from it. I know of all the songs that I know how to play on a guitar, the most I know are Nirvana's, you know, because they're actually quite simple songs to play, and you feel like you're achieving something in quite a short space of time. You know, he's a great, great songwriter, I think.
Oh, a brilliant pop songwriter as well. Like, yeah. Nevermind, every song is just hooks. It's so catchy.
Every single one, you're right. Aye, everyone. And, it's amazing.
And, you know, someone that, you know, DJs in an alternative club and has done nearly 30 years, like, you know, there's times when I never ever want to fucking hear Teen Spirit or Lithium ever again. But about 2 years ago, I went out for a walk, like everyone was doing in the early days of being locked in, and I've been lucky enough to get to interview Butch Vig on here.
I've listened to it,
and what a gen.
He chose Teen Spirit, didn't he?
He mentioned it was almost an honourable mention, but he didn't go for it.
Okay.
But I mean, every right to. Do you know what I mean? And fucking hell, we've done Smashing Pumpkins and Sonic Youth. He could choose all manner. Do you know what I mean? Sugarcane. Oh, afterwards I thought I'm just going to listen to Nevermind, and I went out and I just put it on, and I've heard that record fucking 130,000 times. But I just put it on again and just tried to sort of listen to it with fresh ears. And I honestly think it's just perfect. Like, there's Drain You's my favourite. I love Drain You. That's an intro.
Territorial Pissings is an intro as well, though, man.
Seeing that on Jonathan Ross.
I know. They were supposed to be playing. Because he introduced it as.
Was it meant to have been Come As You Are?
Oh, Come As You Are, that's right. And then everything went mental.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That was another punk as well, I think. Mm. You know, even though his sort of sensibilities arguably weren't quite that, because he was slightly more kind of, his lyrics were always slightly more less of a call to arms than maybe a lot of punk lyrics were. And he was more, he was poetic. He just, I remember him saying he just liked the way that he liked painting pictures with words. And you, that, yeah, if you give yourself up to that, it's what he takes you on an amazing journey, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a fucking tragedy, eh? But yeah, who knows where we'd be if he was still around?
Well, there's rumours, isn't there, that there's a record that's never going to see the light of day that Kurt and Michael Stipe wrote together. What I'd give to hear that. Like,
really?
Yeah, because apparently, like you know, he reached out to Stipe. I think REM was like a massive, massive sort of love of him. And yeah, and apparently, I think that the track on Monster, Let Me In, is written about Kurt. And so, in and around that time, yeah, I think like they were working together, and I guess at the time, REM were the kings of that kind of acoustic mandolin-y thing, and obviously Nirvana had just done Unplugged. Like, I don't know if it's going to be in that vein, but oh, I'd love to have heard anything that them two might have worked on together.
Aye, fucking hell, man.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's got it, Jen? Has Michael Stipe got it? And he's just...
I don't know. I imagine he's probably got some kind of hold on it if it does exist, as, you know, as the rumours have it, but... You know, another incredible vocalist there. You know, underrated vocalist, Michael Stipe.
Did you watch? Have you watched Song Exploder? You know, or well, it's a podcast as well, isn't it? I love that show, man. That's so good.
Hearing
they did Losing My Religion, didn't they? On that, yeah.
I'm a fucking geek for shit like that, Mark. Like,
me too.
Seeing them just taking it down to just the strings.
I know.
You just think, oh man, I love that.
Somebody was talking about the McCartney and Rick Rubin thing. McCartney 3-2-1, is it called?
But I've not heard that.
Oh, I think it's called McCartney 3-2-1 or McCartney 1-2-3. But it's Rick Rubin taking McCartney through. I don't know if it's like a selection of the old stuff. It must be a selection. But yeah, and it's exactly that. It's like taking it down, going, wow. What's that? What's that noise I can hear there? Who played that? And it's McCartney. And apparently it's just fucking delightful because McCartney obviously just is, you know, in love with that whole time, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a wee recommendation, man. Because I can't wait to get my hands on it. I think it's... I don't know where it is, Netflix or... Oh, no, it's Disney Plus. It's Disney Plus. So if you have access to...
I have got that. Have you listened to McCartney on Buxton?
Yes.
Oh, love yes. That, man. You could hear that Adam was almost nervous at the beginning.
I know. I love Adam Buxton.
Oh, man.
I worked with Joe. I did The Kid Who Would Be King, you know, Joe's film. I did a wee bit in that, and as did Adam.
Yeah.
But I was a little bit. I mean, I was nervous. I've been doing this 25 years, and I only had about, I don't know, four lines in it or something. But I took it because it was him, and I took it because I hadn't done much film, you know. And I thought, well, it'll be a good wee credit on my CV, you know. But it was just great. But I was so fucking nervous before I started. I was like, oh my god, because I've been listening to Adam and Joe for fucking years, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan, and I always listen to Adam's podcast as well. You know, I think he's got a real ability to kind of I don't know, to get wonderful conversations out of people.
He's the best. He's the absolute best.
Yeah,
he really is. And I will listen to people that I'm not really that interested in because I know that it's still going to be great because it's Adam.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you listened to the Nicky Wire episode.
I did. Yeah, that was brilliant, wasn't it?
That's amazing.
And wow. I'm not a big, I've never been a big Mannix fan, but it was superb. The way the conversation went was just, it was really fascinating.
I'm going to take you home.
Yeah, go on.
Track 6. Favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Now I'm cheating slightly here. Because Jerry Rafferty's for Paisley.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really lived anywhere near Paisley. But I know a lot of people make the mistake of, oh, I thought it was country. Oh, my God.
Yep.
But I'm using the sort of Glasgow, because I've lived in Fife and I've lived in Lanarkshire. It's near enough, you know.
Yeah.
This is another song that a very recent kind of song on my sort of musical horizons, but it really made a huge impression on me. It's called Whatever's Written in Your Heart. And I know that I've heard Billy Connolly talking about Jerry Rafferty really in a beautiful way. And I obviously knew who he was because of Baker Street and stuff. And I can't remember how this song came into my kind of like world. I think somebody might have put it on a mix or something like that. But I think it's just the most beautiful, simple, incredibly, you know, incredibly crafted song. You know, and the lyrics are just so heartfelt and so, you know, whatever's written in your heart, whatever's written in your heart is all that matters. You know, it's you'll find a way to get it out someday. It makes me cry because I think about my kids when I listen to it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And I think, well, you know, if you want to say, well, you want to say many things to your kids to arm them for the future, but that's one of them, you know. That's a beautiful sentiment.
I've never heard anything other than Baker Street, I think, until I was prepping for this and had a listen. Stop me in my tracks. It's stunning, isn't it?
Yeah, it's properly beautiful. Mm. Properly beautiful, and I don't think there's much more you can say about it other than just listen to the bloody song because it lifts you to and this is what all great music does. It lifts you to another place. That's what that Louis Armstrong song does. It takes you somewhere you've never been before, be that emotionally or spiritually or, you know, whatever. It should lift you up out of yourself and enlighten, you know.
Yeah.
The best of music.
Yeah.
And that does that, I think.
Well, Mark's last track, and this is where you get an opportunity to turn someone onto something new. A song that many may not know, that you would like them to hear, please.
Yeah, this was hard. This was hard too. because fucking hell, first of all, you're presuming that the majority of people haven't heard what you're about to say, but this again is another newish one on me that Keith in one of our mixes he put on, and I was like, what is that? And it's called Palante, and it's by Hooray for the Riff Raff. And I think she's Venezuelan, and Palante means forward. And it's just it kind of starts off. I love songs that kind of start off in one place and finish in an entirely different place by way of. In this middle section that there is, it's a kind of Beatles-y, a weird like Sgt. Pepper-y kind of feel to that bum, bum, bum. You know, there's a wee kind of odd middle, not eighth, middle fucking 32. But and she sings another wee bit there. And then suddenly at the end, it moves into this kind of full of this full of grandeur moment where she shouts, forward, brothers, to my brothers and my sisters, forward to my mother and my father, forward. You just think, wow. That's, again, you know, although she comes from a completely different place than I do, the sentiment is human, you know, and universal, you know. And I just, it gives me, and I'm getting them now talking about it, but it always gives me goosebumps, you know, up my back. And I love songs that do that, you know, when you just think about them, not even when you hear them, but when you think about a song, you go, oh yeah, there's that bit. oh. It's what an amazing thing to be able to do to people. You know?
Yeah. There's a thing that apparently Michael Jackson used on one of his last records, and I was working with this. I was talking to someone that was producing this. Oh, what was this band called? They had an incredible name. Oh, God. Not that long ago. But.
Like, it's like talking to myself, Stu.
Oh, fucking hell, mate. But. But they've got this kind of these frequencies, and this gets put into the production, which apparently triggers goosebumps.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's just there's a kind of science behind it, and because not everybody gets goosebumps, do they?
Yeah,
and whatever it is with this kind of thing that they've been working on can kind of induce and bring out like a goosebump. Like kind of reaction to something that
Jesus like, that's. That's at equal times amazing and really fucking pisses me off as well.
Yeah, it should be an emotional response, right?
I know. Don't fucking try and trigger me. But yeah. That's what people do. That's what musicians have been and actors and fucking artists and whoever have been trying. And then you do down the club, you know. When you're putting on, you're thinking, this is going to really fucking rock their world, you know. That
kind of, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what you want to do is make people happy, doesn't it? So
absolutely.
Natural.
Well, we've got a great playlist to be listened to over on Spotify now, Mark. And we've put all your honourable mentions on there as well. So people can go and explore everything we've chatted about today. I knew this was going to be a really nice natter.
Oh, mate, it's been an absolute joy.
Oh, thanks, mate. It's been great. And I'm going to keep you on the call when I press stop because I want to ask you something anyway.
Okay.
But Mark, thank you so much, mate. I mean, but also, what's coming up? What's next for you?
I'm working. This is why my hair's like this. But I'm doing I can't tell you about it. But I'm doing a job just now, which I can't tell you about. But that is very exciting. ITV 4-part drama. But next, well, imminently is the second series of Guilt. Which is due out sort of, I think, just over a month away or thereabouts, October, I think. Okay. I'm safe to say that. Yeah. So, yeah, you get to find out all about what's happened to Max and Jake since the end of series one, since I got taken down.
Mm.
That's very exciting. And I'm very excited to be a part of The Rig, which is a new Amazon sort of sci-fi kind of great story by David McPherson, and the new series of Shetland will be out fairly soon as well. So there's lots been happening. So yes, it's good. Long may it continue. Touch wood. Guilt is the most imminent thing.
Okay, and if people want to kind of keep up to speed on everything about this. Instagram, the best place to keep up to speed with you?
Yeah, Instagram and Twitter. I'm on them both. I don't check them as often as I probably should. But yeah, you can catch up with me there.
Wonderful. Mark's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. Enjoy, mate.
My pleasure.
There you go. In case you was wondering, like I was, Dream Theater was the band that Mark couldn't remember at the beginning. I was like, don't go anywhere after this chat. I need to know, because I would have had like a weekend of sleepless nights just thinking, prog band, early 90s, who would that have been? Dream Theater. Like I said at the beginning, we stuck on the Zoom and had a lovely chat talking about music documentaries and records and such. So, what a lovely guy. Feel great. I'm recording this intro and outro just after we've had that chat. So still buzzing from that marvellous natter. And like I said as well at the beginning, there's loads of marvellous natters to be enjoyed in the back catalogue. So go and explore that at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com or just get it wherever you get your podcasts. Simples. Right, I'm back next time. Thanks once again to Mark, and thanks again and always to you lovely lot for listening, supporting, and just being nice. Have a smashing week. I'll see you next time. Much love. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stu, with him.